Hi, I'm Natalie Morales. One of the most powerful and emotional datelines I worked on, The Phone Call, takes place in Kansas City, Kansas. A couple was found shot to death in their home. Suspicion centered on one man who had plenty of reason to be angry. But was it all as it seemed? It's a mystery that had everybody asking not just who was the killer, but who was the real victim. It's a story also about the power of the human spirit and the length some will go to ensure justice is served. It was early spring, a Monday morning in Kansas City, Kansas. Two teenagers were trying not to be late for school.
Shoveling some cereal down to each hour is getting dressed. And then Dad would start the car and wait for us to come out and get in.
Their father drove the family van just down the cul-de-sac to the bus stop. An unremarkable day, until it wasn't.
I was fiddling with something, not paying attention. My dad stopped the car and I looked up and there were people getting out of a car that was pulled up in front of us with guns.
Melody was 14 at the time, Ben 17.
And there was an immediate onset of fear. I don't think you can feel anything else when two people jump out of a car and point guns at your face.
Yelled at me to make sure that they could see my hands, so I was leaned over with my hands visible to the windshield. And then I saw a black and white cruiser pull around the corner, and I felt such relief.
But the police weren't there to help. They were there with handcuffs.
I remember kneeling in front of the van with a shotgun pointed at the back of my head as several officers surrounded me.
Did they say what they were doing?
Nobody said anything as to what was going on.
Are you crying or emotional or fearful?
I was focused on breathing.
The family members were put in police cruisers. On the way to the station, Ben passed a house swarming with police.
I remember seeing some news vans and a whole whirlwind of activity going on in the street, and there was police tape. It looked straight out of a scene from a TV show.
It was a crime scene.
Yeah.
A crime had been committed, that's for sure. It's one thing in the story that everyone can agree on. Maybe the only thing. Here's how it all began. Around 2:30 a.m., a man called 911 saying his sister needed help.
Need to hurry and get somebody there. She called crying and screaming.
The woman who needed help was named Kathleen Schroll. Officers arrived at her house within minutes, but it was too late. Mark Dupree is the current Wyandotte County District Attorney.
Once they go into the home, because it's a small house, within a few steps of entering the door, you see the deceased laying on the floor.
Kathleen Schroll was dead, and she wasn't the only victim.
And then within a few feet from her, the entryway to the bedrooms, where you see her husband laying in the bed, deceased.
Husband Carl had been shot twice.
You could visibly tell that he had gunshot wounds to the chest. There was also blood on his head. And then when you're dealing with Kathleen that is in the living room on the floor, there was a gunshot wound to her head.
Three shots had taken the lives of this married couple. The officers tried to get a handle on the scene.
Was there anything else suspicious in the home, any physical evidence that pointed to breaking and entering or somebody else having been in that home?
So there was no physical evidence to show that there was any type of breaking or entering. The windows were not broken. The door was not kicked in. Furniture was not thrown all around. Nothing was rummaged through.
As for the weapon involved, there was no mistaking it. A .38 revolver lay next to Kathleen's body.
You see the gun laying beside her, just a few feet on her left side from her foot.
The scene appeared to speak for itself. Kathleen Schroll had shot her husband, then taken her own life.
So it was a murder-suicide.
Within the first 10 minutes of the sergeant appearing, the thought was, this is a murder-suicide.
But what did this possible murder-suicide
have to do with those kids and their dad apprehended by police? Well, in a word, everything. Because as you'll see, those two scenes were very much connected. Just not in ways anyone would fully understand for years. Coming up, a daughter finds it hard to believe that her mom and stepdad are dead by her mother's hand.
Did that seem possible to you?
No, that's not my mom. That's not who my mom is or was.
April 7th, 2008. It was the day 21-year-old Blair Hadley awoke to the worst news of her life.
My daughter and I fell asleep in my rocking chair in front of the TV, and when we woke up, we heard banging on the door.
It was her grandma telling her that her mother, Kathleen, and stepfather were dead, found shot to death in their house.
I just wanted to faint. Wanted it to be a dream. Mm-hmm. I just wanted it to be fake. And I asked, what did you say?
It was unimaginable. Blair and her young daughter Caroline had just been with them the night before. They'd planned to sleep over, but there was a problem.
She just said that Carl and I aren't getting along right now. You know how your stepdad is. When he's upset, he just wants to be not bothered. So I think you guys need to go home tonight. And I said, okay.
Her mom and stepdad were in a fight. That much was clear. But dead in a murder-suicide?
Did that seem possible to you?
No.
Why not?
Because that's not my mom. That's not who my mom is or was.
Her mom and Carl may have been having a disagreement that night, but Blair thought their relationship was strong. They'd met when Blair was 10.
Seeing Carl for the first time, what was your first impression?
Mom, he's old.
He was older than she was?
Yes.
Like how much older?
Like 20 years older.
What did she say to that?
Oh, Blair, age is just a number. You're being silly.
Turns out her mom was right. Blair grew very fond of Carl Schroll.
I would call him dad, too.
What did you see in their relationship?
They were so happy, and they were always laughing and joking.
They were the life of the party.
Shannon Elevier is one of Blair's closest friends and like a second daughter to Kathleen.
I remember her teaching me and Blair about being a young lady, you know, and the things that were going to happen to our bodies as being young ladies. And she would always have, you know, spa days.
Kathleen and Carl seemed happy, comfortable. Carl, who once had a steady job at a racetrack, was now retired. And Kathleen worked at a local credit union.
Did she like her job?
Yeah, she seemed like she loved it.
She was, you know, a very pleasant lady to work with.
Sandy Lehman was Kathleen's partner at work.
I would open and she would close, and a lot of times she was at work before me.
Why did you think she was coming in so early?
Well, a lot of times she would give other ladies rides, and then they would sit in the break room and talk until it was their time to go to work.
Kathleen had also had a second job caring for an elderly man.
She said that the man had given her some jewelry and stuff after the wife had passed away.
His name was Olin Coons. He was in his 80s and suffered from dementia. When he died a year earlier, he left Kathleen more than just a token of appreciation. She was the beneficiary on his $42,000 life insurance policy.
What about money? Did she say anything about money or the house?
She did say that they had left her a house that she was working on.
Seemed awfully generous, right?
It did.
What do you remember about Olin?
He was a really, really nice man.
And was your mother loving towards him, caring? Did she feel like it was more than just, I'm working for them?
Yeah, like, it was like her father. Like, she really cared for him, really loved him a lot.
Yeah, that was Kathy's priority. Her priority was, of course, Blair, but her priority was also to care for Olin.
Olin's passing had hit Kathleen hard, but Blair thought her mother weathered it well.
I thought she was fine. You know, she was working at the credit union, so I thought, Mom's doing great.
But there was one thing in Kathleen's life that wasn't so great. For months, Kathleen had been embroiled in a bitter lawsuit. It involved money, and she said it wasn't looking good for the other party.
My mom told me that he was gonna lose and that he was mad.
But how mad? That question would turn out to consume the investigation. Because as Kathleen's friends and family saw it, this was no murder-suicide. This was a cold-hearted execution, and they knew just who was responsible. Coming up, could a legal battle have gone from contentious to dangerous?
She thought the court case was getting ready to come to an end and that he was getting desperate, is how she worded it.
Your mom was afraid for her life at that point?
Yes.
Not long after police discovered the bodies of Carl and Kathleen Schroll, a car pulled up to the scene. It was Kathleen's mother and brother, and they had an earful for the detectives.
It wasn't until the family of the deceased arrived to the scene that things began to shift from a murder-suicide possibility to this is Pete Coons who killed our loved ones.
Pete Coons is the man who was in an ongoing legal dispute with Kathleen. Her mother and brother were convinced he'd murdered her. They told Blair their suspicions when they delivered the news.
And they were like, he got her. And I was like, who got her? It's like, Pete killed your mom.
Pete was the son of the elderly man Kathleen had taken care of. Family and friends say that Pete was upset that his dad had given so many of his assets to Kathleen, and he wasn't taking it lying down. Kathleen's work friend, Sandy.
She had said that they were fighting over the house and the money. You know, she had said that he was a drug addict, and that's why his family gave the money to her instead of them.
Why Olin, his father,
yes,
gave the money to her?
To her instead of him because, you know, she'd said he had drug problems and all this stuff.
From Blair's point of view, Pete didn't have much of a presence in his dad's life either.
You helped take care of Olin in his last few years. Did he ever talk about his son?
I never heard him say Pete. Never heard him talk about him.
But after Olin died, Pete contested Kathleen's claim to his father's life insurance policy. And she said Pete started badgering her.
She would tell me every time he would come to her work or see her at the gas station or anything like that.
Did she ever say anything to lead you to think that he was somebody to be afraid of?
Just that he kept threatening her, saying that she was stealing money and stuff like that from his father.
Kathleen suspected Pete had even vandalized the house his dad left her.
She thought he had gone in and stole the plumbing out of the house.
Kathleen said the harassment was constant and getting worse.
She thought the court case was getting ready to come to an end and that, you know, he was getting desperate is how she worded it.
Getting desperate.
Yes.
Then Saturday, just 2 days before Kathleen and Carl were shot to death, a confrontation. Kathleen told her friends and family that Pete had gotten in her face at a local convenience store.
What did she say?
She had said that Pete had confronted her at the Quick Trip convenience store the morning before she came to work and kind of threatened her and said that she'd never be able to use any of the money you get.
He passed her and said, "You will not be spending no more of my dad's money, bitch," and walked away.
And your mom was afraid for her life at that point?
Yes. I said, did you tell Carl? She said, no, because nobody does anything about it anymore. I said, are you going to call the cops? She said, no, because they won't do nothing because he didn't touch me.
It was just two mornings later that Kathleen and her husband were found dead.
Your minds were all racing and you're putting it all together.
Yes.
You're already assuming that Pete went over there and killed Kathleen and Carl?
That's what everybody was kind of assuming, yes.
Pete's involvement made sense to Blair's friend Shannon, too.
I thought, wow, like, with knowing that he was harassing her, I thought for sure they had definitely had the right person.
But this history wasn't the only reason police decided this was a double homicide, not a murder-suicide. There was also a phone call that was just about as good as an eyewitness to murder. Coming up,
your grandmother got this very scary phone call.
Yes. My mom had called her and told her that Pete was there and that he was killing Carl and he was going to kill her next.
Kathleen's family was sure of it. Pete Koons had killed Kathleen and her husband, Carl. And it wasn't just what they'd heard about the bad blood over his father's estate or her story of an ugly confrontation. It was a phone call Kathleen made around 2:30 a.m., just minutes before she was shot.
Your grandmother got this very scary phone call.
Yes. My mom had called her and told her that Pete was there and that he was killing Carl and he was going to kill her next.
It was word from the victim herself. Pete Koons was in the house with intent to kill. When police heard that, it seems that any ambiguity about the case fell away. DA Mark Dupree.
And that was the piece of information that the police had received that ultimately led them to go and arrest Pete.
Arrest him as he drove his kids to the school bus. Pete Koons is the father of those two teens at the beginning of our story.
They handcuffed me in the front and put me in the back of a police cruiser and walked away.
That morning, Pete's wife, Dee, says she had no idea what was happening with her husband or kids.
He should have went down to the bus stop and been back in 10 minutes. Well, almost an hour later, he's not there. And I'm like, oh my God, well, maybe he'd take the kids to school, but he still would have been back by now.
What were you thinking could have happened?
They were in a ditch somewhere, that they'd had a car wreck, Pete had a heart attack, and they, you know, that's really what I thought.
Pete and Dee have five children. Their eldest daughter, Mariah, was in college and living at home.
That was not normal for him to just disappear and be gone. So I called the high school and I said, well, I need these two students. And they said, they never showed up.
Are you freaking out yourself?
Oh, by that point, I'm terrified.
Mariah jumped in the car with her then boyfriend, now husband, Ross.
We drove every route that my dad had ever taken me to get to school.
So you were driving around. What are you looking for, Ross?
Anything that looked like their van. Anything that looked like their van that possibly could have been an accident, where there might have been an accident.
But, of course, there was no accident. The two teenagers who'd been with their dad in the van were down at the station in interrogation rooms. Melody was 14.
I was just very, very confused and afraid and on the verge of tears. And I had zero insight as to what could possibly be happening.
And sitting there for how long?
Hours. A few different people kept coming in to get my information, asked my name, my birthday, my mom's phone number multiple times, which I gave every time thinking she's going to come get me.
They also had a few questions about her dad.
I was just trying to answer their questions because I didn't want to make them angry. And I remember really wanting to ask for my mom, but the male detective seemed so aggressive that I was too scared to ask for anything. I was too scared to ask to go to the bathroom. I was too scared to ask for a drink.
Ben, who was 17 then, says he was scared too.
Eventually, two officers came in and started
questioned me about where my dad was the night before, what he was wearing, what he was doing, what I was doing the night before. And I couldn't really give him too much information because I hadn't paid that much attention. Not to mention, I was already internally panicking and kind of shutting down to try and deal with what was going on. I was handcuffed to a chair in a interrogation room by myself for a solid 3 hours.
It was afternoon when Ben and Melody were returned home.
Two cop cars pulled up. They got out. Melody was a ball of tears. I still didn't know what was going on.
Dee says she was completely in the dark until a detective finally laid it all out. Her husband had been arrested for the murders of Kathleen and Carl Schroll.
They came back with a warrant, and the phrase they used was, we gotta toss this house. And believe me, they tossed the house.
Do you remember that experience?
I remember when they came to search our home. I don't even know what they were really looking for at the time.
Investigators confiscated computers and looked for guns and ammunition. They also searched Pete's van for gunshot residue and blood.
Meantime, are you thinking at all about the night before? Is it possible we don't know our dad like we thought we did?
No.
No.
Not a second.
No.
Was there ever a thought in your mind? Maybe?
No.
Never.
Never.
Never, because the family says they knew something the police did not. Coming up, why Dee says she's positive her husband was home the entire night of the murders.
I can remember hearing coughing all night long. He woke me up coughing between 2, 2:15, and then again at 4:30.
Will investigators believe her? Coons was under arrest for gunning down Kathleen and Carl Schroll. His wife, Dee, simply could not believe it.
At this point, are you thinking this is all just a huge mistake? This
yes.
will all be fine
yes.
tomorrow.
Yes.
To Dee, Pete was a devoted husband and dad, a career letter carrier with the U.S. Postal Service to whom she had been married for almost 30 years.
I couldn't imagine a day going by not talking to him, seeing him, being with him.
The kids loved their dad, the fun-loving guy who lived to make them smile, especially at the holidays.
One year, my house for Christmas was so lit up. We were in the car driving around looking at Christmas lights because that was one of our traditions. And one of my younger siblings was like, we want to go see that house because we can see it. And Dad's like, that's our house. It's our house.
He likes to talk about going fishing all the time. I went fishing with him on a fairly regular basis. He used to be a touring musician back in the 60s, 70s. And I kind of started to play the drums because that's what he played. So, of course, that's what I wanted to play.
In their minds, their father was no murderer. And it wasn't just because they loved him. They say they knew exactly where he was when Kathleen and Carl were shot. They'd all been at home together.
He was on the computer. I can remember hearing coughing all night long. He woke me up coughing between 2, 2:15, something like that. I remember him going to the bathroom, and then again at 4:30. He woke me up again, 4:30, coughing.
But their recollections didn't make a difference. Pete Coons was formally charged with double homicide.
How quickly was he charged?
It was pretty fast, within 48 hours.
News of the arrest didn't immediately ease the pain of Kathleen's daughter, Blair. Her mom had been her rock, her best friend. Without her, she felt lost.
She was just so loving and caring. God, I miss her so much.
I stayed with Blair for at least the first couple days, and then it was like I couldn't leave her. You know, she would cry and beg for me to stay up and watch her go to sleep because she was in so much pain. And that was really hard. That was really hard.
Perhaps getting justice for Kathleen and Carl would help. In January 2009, Pete Coons went on trial for their murders. Mark Dupree wasn't yet the DA, but has reviewed the case.
What was the prosecution's theory of what happened?
The prosecutor was of the mindset that Mr. Coons went to the house, killed them, and then went home because he did not like Kathleen.
No other suspects were investigated?
No.
Not a possibility of somebody just off the street walking in?
No.
The prosecutor who tried the case told the jury that the reason for the shooting was that Pete had a royal gripe with Kathleen. She had stolen his inheritance, and he wanted it back.
That was the motive.
That was the motive.
Blair took the stand and told the jury about that run-in her mother described with Pete at the convenience store.
After the gas station, after he threatened her, then that's when she really got scared.
The prosecutor said 37 hours after that confrontation, Pete sneaked out of his home and headed to the Schrolls in a fit of rage. He barged in and used some type of weapon, not a gun, to bash Carl over the head.
The thought was, from our office, that it was simply a blunt force to the head, and that bruise was caused by him being hit.
Then, the prosecutor said, Pete grabbed Kathleen's gun and fired three bullets, shooting Carl twice and then killing Kathleen from behind. Medical examiner Eric Mitchell concluded that the evidence pointed to double homicide, not murder-suicide, as the responding sergeant initially suggested.
Kathleen had a gunshot wound to the back of the head.
That's correct.
Making it hard to believe she could have shot herself. And the state's proof that Pete pulled the trigger? That phone call from Kathleen. Her mother took the stand and described it word for word for the jury. She said Kathleen sounded scared. Mom, Pete is in the house and is going to kill Carl and then kill me, she said. Kathleen repeated it, and then the phone went dead.
Yes, my name is Randy Horton.
It was Kathleen's brother who called 911 and relayed his sister's words.
My sister just called, and she's had some run-ins with this one guy. She called him sister. He's there trying to kill her and her husband. He's there now. She said he's breaking in with the gun in his hand.
Okay, and the guy that's supposed to be there, what, the suspect, what's his name?
Pete. Pete Coons.
That phone call was the evidence?
Yes, that was the evidence that put him there. That was the evidence that our office used to say how they knew that Mr. Coons was in the house.
Pete Coons, named right there in the 911 call as a man Kathleen said was in the house. An open and shut case as far as the prosecutor was concerned. But Pete's attorney would have a very different take on the story. She believed Pete Coons was an innocent man. Coming up...
I believed it was a murder-suicide from the beginning. There was no sign of a struggle. Nothing was messed up in the house at all. It was her gun. She carried it with her in her purse.
But what would the jury believe? Pete Coons was on trial for the double homicide of Kathleen and Carl Schroll. But his family was convinced police had zeroed in on the wrong man from the start.
They decided Dad was guilty, and they never looked. They never put any effort into anything else. They decided he was guilty, and that was it.
Pete's defense attorney, Patty Kolb, agreed.
There was just no way that he could have done anything the way they said he did it.
For one thing, there was absolutely nothing linking Pete to the crime scene. No blood, no DNA, no fingerprint evidence.
There's no physical evidence at this point to show that Pete was anywhere near or in the house or near Kathy and her husband, Carl.
No DNA evidence, no any kind of trace evidence, no indication that he'd ever been in the house.
And what's more, she said it was physically impossible for Pete to have committed the murders. His wife, Dee, testified about what she remembered. Pete waking up to use the bathroom in the middle of the night and typing on the computer.
So there's no chance he went out?
Absolutely not.
Pete's daughter Mariah and Ross were up late watching TV in the living room.
We started watching a movie, and her dad came out of their bedroom, and he told us to not stay up too much longer.
We saw him. I mean, we physically laid eyes on him at the time that they said he was out of the house.
And talked to him.
There's no way he could have been anywhere else.
They told the jury they were still awake around 2:30 a.m. when the shooting took place.
Did you hear any other movement, any other sounds that signaled your dad was still at home?
He was coughing.
And we could hear the keyboard.
And he did. There was some clicking.
As for motive, Pete's attorney had to concede he was in a dispute over his father's assets. But she said there was no proof that Pete was harassing Kathleen or that there had been a confrontation.
In terms of threats, was there any surveillance footage showing that Pete maybe approached her at a convenience store?
Detective Michaels said that there was not. He said he went and checked it out, I believe, and that was brought up.
There was never a restraining order filed with the police
by
Kathleen.
No.
Pete didn't testify at trial on the advice of his attorney, but he did tell his story to us.
This is not real. I kept thinking, I'm going to wake up.
Pete says that as he sat there in court listening, he kept thinking about his father, Olin.
My dad always told me, if you're in trouble, go find a policeman. Never be afraid, because our system works and they'll get it right.
Pete says from the moment he was arrested, he felt trapped in some kind of fiction.
It's like you're in a real bad movie. It's like you're watching something happen to somebody else. You're sitting there thinking, how do you have this so wrong?
Pete says he was utterly confused as detectives grilled him.
I kept telling him, look, just go and investigate.
Did they tell you why at that point they were so sure it was you?
Nope. He said, I know it's you.
And now in court, he said, the bad movie continued.
And how were you portrayed?
As a cold-blooded killer.
Their evidence was you wanted Kathleen dead because you weren't getting results quickly enough in your legal case.
Well, but that's the absurdity of it. We were getting ready to go to court on the legal issue to settle the life insurance dispute. I'm certainly smart enough to know that if you kill somebody, you can't take them to court.
And motive, a life insurance policy.
A $42,000 life insurance policy. I can see the fact that they say there's motive, but my motive was they needed to be alive because I couldn't get any of that money unless everybody was alive and able to go to court.
And your anger towards Kathleen at that point, was that enough of a motive?
To this day, people just don't believe that it's possible, but I never hated Kathleen.
Pete's attorney, Patty Cobb, told the jury there was only one logical explanation for what had happened inside the Schroll residence. And it was just what the arriving sergeant on scene had suggested as he observed Kathleen lying by a gun. Her gun.
I believed it was a murder-suicide from the beginning. There was no sign of a struggle. Nothing was messed up in the house at all. Carl was on the bed, and she was right in front of the middle of the living room. It was a very small house, and was dead, but it was her gun. She carried it with her in her purse. I mean...
The defense said this was part of the state's case that made absolutely no sense. If Pete showed up intending to kill Kathleen, why didn't he bring a gun of his own to do it?
And then also, there was no sign of a struggle.
Correct.
So how would he have gotten the gun?
That was what I hoped the jury would see.
How do you explain, though, the phone call that Kathleen's mother said that she made?
Well, now, truly, I always believed, in my heart of hearts, that phone call never happened.
What was fact and what was fiction? Now it would be up to 12 jurors to decide. Coming up, a verdict nobody is expecting.
I was confused. Literally confused.
A family friend was sitting with us, and she actually covered my eyes.
And later, a new witness with a damning tale.
You used the words, repeating what Pete had told you, that he, quote, covered his tracks.
Oh, he said that multiple times.
The jury was deliberating Pete Koons' fate in the murder trial of Kathleen Schroll and her husband, Carl. And Pete, he thought he was going home.
I was thinking, well, let's see, we can go to McDonald's when I get out of here.
You already moved on.
I'd already moved on. Because how could they get it so wrong? And that still goes back to that belief of the system don't make mistakes.
On the other side of the courtroom sat Kathleen's daughter, Blair.
I just knew he did it only because of the phone call. Why would my mom say that? My mom wouldn't lie about it.
Blair's best friend, Shannon, wanted justice too, but found herself questioning the state's case.
There was no physical evidence, you know, and I thought, man, this is going to be hard. This is going to be hard for them to convict him with no physical evidence.
On day two of deliberations, the jury notified the judge that it had a verdict.
So when the jury walks back in, did they make eye contact?
No, scared the daylights out of me. I looked at Patty and she just had a panicked look on her face.
First, in the murder of Kathleen Schroll, the jury found Pete Koons guilty.
I turned around and looked at my wife and my children. And I thought, what are you guys gonna do?
A family friend was sitting with us and she actually pulled my head into her chest and covered my eyes.
Everything went mute for a little bit because I just couldn't comprehend what I was hearing.
And then there was that second verdict. In the death of Carl Schroll, the jury found Pete Koons not guilty.
I was confused. Literally confused.
Did you feel like justice had been done?
No. Because what about my stepdad? He was somebody.
It was a strange conclusion. Two people killed, only one guilty verdict.
The way that they postulated that it happened, there's no way he could have been guilty of one but not the other. He would have had to have been guilty of both.
Pete was sentenced to 50 years without parole. For him, that amounted to a life sentence. He told us the jury didn't get the full story about Kathleen.
How was she portrayed in the trial?
The prosecutor said she was a wonderful woman who was just working as a caregiver because she cared so much for people.
But Pete believed Kathleen had been taking advantage of his dad for years. Like Olin's life insurance, Pete never thought his dad meant to leave it to her. He thinks Kathleen altered it herself.
That life insurance policy had been changed. The detectives discovered over the internet.
So she became 100% his beneficiary.
Exactly.
And Pete says Kathleen had purposely driven a wedge between him and his dad, keeping Olin cut off from the family.
Because we'd go over, nobody had answered the door. No, we had no idea what was going on. I mean, I even called and begged her on the phone to please let his grandkids come see him.
And it was becoming impossible to see your dad, to visit him.
It was impossible. She told me, he doesn't ever want to see you again. And if you're going to see him, you'll have to bring the police.
Pete and Dee had a family friend stop by the house. That friend managed to talk Kathleen into letting her take Olin out for dinner. She reunited him with his family.
What did he look like when you saw him for the first time?
He had huge sores on his nose. He had scratches on his face. He had bruises on his arm. He had bed sores that were terrible. He was in atrocious shape.
Pete moved his dad into his house. He filed an elder abuse complaint, and police were sent to investigate.
How angry are you at this point?
Well, certainly I was angry. But that goes back into the life that my father had installed into me. I had already contacted the police. I had detectives working on it. So I wasn't worried because the system was going to work.
But now, sitting in prison, Pete believed the system hadn't worked at all.
How do you explain to a family your dad is going to be locked away, maybe for life?
There is no real explanation.
I treated it almost like a death and coped with it that way.
Pete's children felt their anger mostly directed at law enforcement.
It caused a lot of emotional trauma for me to know that I'm telling the truth and be told over and over and over I'm lying and not being able to, who has physical proof of where they're at in the middle of the night?
That was the first time I really learned how to hate people. How to actually hate somebody. I felt a lot of anger towards people I had never met before for betraying me and my family.
As Pete's family tried to deal with his absence, he settled into the lonely existence of prison life.
So morning to night, is it just one day after another, time just ticks slowly by?
Every morning, I got up and I started looking for the reason that I wanted to get up the next day. That sounds strange, but you have to find a reason to keep going. When you're in prison for something you didn't do, serving a life sentence, there's no finish line.
Pete says he had a hard time imagining how all this would end, but his attorney had made a discovery that she believed could change everything. Coming up, the tale told by a computer disk.
That was evidence that proved you were home at the time?
I believed it was.
New evidence, but also a new witness against Pete.
He told me that he thought about doing something to these people and nobody was going to be able to figure out he did it.
From her mother's murder up through the trial, Kathleen's daughter Blair had been haunted by the specter of Pete Coons.
I automatically thought he was the monster. You know, I couldn't sleep at night because I was so scared that he was going to come for me.
But now that Pete was convicted, Blair felt some relief. So did her friend Shannon.
We were all so happy that there was a conviction because this man killed Kathy and killed Carl. And, you know, we got to hold somebody accountable for this.
But any closure they were experiencing didn't last long because Pete's defense attorney discovered something that she believed would have made a big difference. The trial had already started when the prosecutor gave her a disk of documents from Pete's computer. At the time, she believed it was a copy of evidence she already had.
When I got done with the case that day, went and looked at it, and it showed all of this evidence that there was somebody on the computer at certain times, like right after the alleged time of the murder and right before.
Pete's wife and kids had mentioned hearing him on his computer that night, but the jury never got a chance to see the computer logs that appeared to back up that story.
That was evidence that proved you were home at the time?
I believed it was.
Pete's attorney, Patty Cobb, filed a motion requesting a new trial, stating that the prosecution failed to turn over the computer evidence in a timely manner. And the judge granted it.
He said, I'm ordering a new trial right now.
So 11 months after trial number one, all parties returned to the courthouse for trial two. Because Pete was found not guilty in Carl's murder the first time, this trial would only concern Kathleen's death.
So the second trial, are you feeling confident this time? This will go my way.
Miss Kalb said to me, well, I got your one not guilty the first time. Let's go get the other one.
Did you trust her at this point?
I did, because she got me one not guilty. And yes, I trusted her.
The prosecutor told this jury the same story he told the first jury about Pete and Kathleen warring over estate money, their confrontation at the convenience store, the crime scene with Kathleen shot in the back of the head, and of course, Kathleen telling her family that Pete was in the house.
She called and said that he's there trying to kill her and her husband.
The defense fired back, leaning into that new computer evidence and suggesting once again that Kathleen had pulled the trigger herself.
I actually thought we presented a better case the second trial.
But the prosecutor did have a new key witness, someone who came forward after the first trial.
When my attorney told me there's a guy named Robert Rupert going to testify against you, I said, who?
Pete met Robert Rupert in jail. They had shared a cell briefly. Pete says he hardly remembered him, but here he was now, the state's star witness.
What was his story?
His story was that Mr. Coons told him everything and that Mr. Coons committed this crime.
The inmate's name, who are we talking about?
A.K.A. Pete.
Pete, okay.
Rupert told the jury much the same story he told detectives in this audio-taped interview.
He would tell me stuff about his criminal case and get real mad and talk about committing the crime and getting away with it.
You used the words, repeating what Pete had told you, that he, quote, covered his tracks.
Oh, he said that multiple times.
Okay.
He told me that he thought about it for quite a long time, about doing something to these people, about what they did to his dad, and nobody was going to be able to figure out he did it.
Rupert had lots of details about the murder to share as well.
Did he indicate to you how he exited his house in order not to alert or stir anyone within the home?
He told me that he went out the bedroom window, that he had a hard time getting out the bedroom window. He claims that he was, like, real big at the time, but he was laughing about it. But he finally got out the window.
What's more, he suggested to detectives that Pete's wife, Dee, had been an accomplice.
Yeah, she was in the bedroom when he went out the window. She helped him get out the window and close the window after he left, yeah.
After that, Rupert said Pete drove to the Schrolls in a red Jeep.
He said, I went over there in my Jeep. I didn't use my personal van, my family van. He also, in the same conversation, told me that he had his wife sell the Jeep to get rid of it so there wouldn't be around.
As he listened to Rupert's story, Pete was in disbelief. Not only did he think Rupert was lying, but he also thought his details were demonstrably false. Yes, Pete had owned a red Jeep, for example, but he'd sold it well before the crime.
A letter carrier named James Rumley bought that Jeep from me about a year and a month prior to the murders. I no longer had a red Jeep.
What else did Robert Rupert say you told him?
Well, he told the jury that I climbed out a window. And I've got to be truthful with you, at that time, weighing close to 300 pounds, I was so fat I couldn't have got through a window if my life would have depended on it. If the house would have been on fire, I'd have burned to death because I couldn't have got out the window.
Again, as in the first trial, Pete chose not to take the stand.
Why not?
In the through discussions with my attorney, she told me that she was confident that we had put forth enough of a defense that there's no way that a sane, that's the word she used, the sane jury could convict us.
Second time you're going through this, to deliberate, what were you feeling in that moment?
I really thought it was going to come back different. I really did, because I couldn't believe that 24 people would believe the scenario.
Describe what you were feeling.
Scared to death.
Coming up, a fresh look at the case could change everything.
The state's theory made no sense.
What baffles you the most?
No one stopped to think, like, wait a second. Why is she calling her 78-year-old mother and not 911?
It was deja vu. The jury deciding Pete Coons' fate filed back into the courtroom to deliver the verdict.
And when they came back in the room the second time, did they look at you?
Nope. I looked at Patty and I said, here we go again.
And then he heard it. The word he'd been dreading. Guilty for the second time.
I turned around, looked at Dee, and she said, she was crying. She said, I don't know what to do for you. You're going to die alone.
I was devastated because you don't even know where to go from there.
What did you tell Pete? Do you remember?
No. Because he turned around to say something and they yanked him back around.
Did you pretty much give up all hope then?
I don't want to say that we gave up hope.
It wasn't plausible. We never understood.
Pete's attorney says the loss was crushing.
I knew that he was an innocent man and believed I had done everything that I could have, and just was, it was bad.
She wasn't the only attorney bothered by the case. Before Pete was even sentenced, his family reached out for help. A defense attorney named Brandon Bell tried to get the conviction thrown out.
We took a look at the case and decided something had gone wrong. The state's theory, it was impossible. It made no sense.
What baffles you the most?
I guess that no one, stopped to think, wait a second. Why is she calling her 78-year-old mother and not 911? The cell phone's right there, and the front door is 5 feet away from her. If this guy has really come in and is killing her husband and says he's going to kill her, why didn't she just run out the front door?
Remember, the state argued that Pete Koons had used a weapon that was not a gun, whacked Carl on the head, and then killed them both with Kathleen's gun. Totally implausible, thought Bell.
Look, his job was as a mail carrier, and even that was, they had to put him on a medical disability because even sitting in a Jeep and delivering the mail was too strenuous to him. But somehow you want us to believe that he got into a house and managed to subdue two adults at 2:30 in the morning and not leave a single object in that house out of place.
But ultimately, Brandon Bell's efforts failed, and Pete was again sentenced to 50 years without parole. Pete began the appeals process. Years went by.
I thought I would never walk out of prison alive because the system had failed me twice.
Dee took more hours at work to support their family and eventually moved out of state. Pete encouraged her to make another decisive break.
I told Dee, you need to get a divorce and move on because you need to live your life.
You know, he did ask me, I've got the papers, all I've got to do is sign them, I'll send them to you, you can sign them, and you can get divorced, it'll be all right. You can go find somebody else. But he was innocent. And you don't walk away from that. Because that would be me telling him that I thought he did it. And I know he didn't.
Ben and Melody graduated high school and tried to get on as well. Ben pursued a degree in psychology, but neither of them could fully escape the family trauma.
You felt broken.
I did for a long time.
Melody, what about for you? Did you feel like a big part of your life was gone?
Absolutely. I mean, I was at a very difficult age as a girl, and I didn't have that role model.
How did you explain to people who didn't really know you, where's your dad?
I told anybody and everybody who would listen. But more often than not, it would be reacted to with a very, are you sure? I just had to accept the fact that people wouldn't believe me.
Their dad's incarceration was also difficult for Pete and Dee's other children. Jeremiah is the oldest.
It was hard. It was hard to even talk to him because it just wasn't fair. I didn't know what to say.
Youngest son Quinn was just 7 when Pete was arrested and says it was lonely growing up as the murderer's son.
The stigma didn't come from the kids. It came from the parents, teachers, staff, places like that. That's where the darting eyes, the glares, the, you know, telling your kids, oh, don't talk to them. Their dad killed somebody.
You remember all of that clearly.
Oh, yeah.
What that felt like.
Oh, the ostracization, you know, just the people talked to me differently.
Time passed, but the family was stuck on pause. Each holiday without Pete a painful reminder of his absence.
Each birthday that went by.
Every anniversary, every Christmas, Halloween, and the 4th of July. Those were his holidays.
Pete's daughters grew up, married. Melody asked Ben to walk her down the aisle. Mariah couldn't bring herself to have a wedding.
We got married. I refused to have a wedding. Like, I couldn't do it. I couldn't bring myself to have a wedding. Because he wasn't there.
While Pete was behind bars, he also became a grandfather. But he decided it was better for the grandkids not to know he was alive.
Why did you not want your grandchildren to know that you were in prison?
I didn't want my grandchildren to have to live with the stigma of Grandpa being in prison. That's a terrible thing for a family to live with.
As he approached a decade behind bars, Pete had exhausted his appeals. He says he was losing his will to live.
Did you think even about taking your own life?
Yes, I did.
You gave up?
I told my wife that I'd never spend 10 years in one day. It was all going to end at 10 years. I didn't know whether I was weak enough, not strong enough, weak enough to take my own life or not. But I planned every bit of it.
How were you going to do it?
With a sheet tied with knots in it, I was going to hang myself.
But there, in his darkest moments, Pete found a ray of light, a couple he met in prison, who, like Pete's family, believed he had been wrongly convicted.
We gave him compassion.
Yeah.
Empathy.
Sandy was Pete's boss at the prison laundry. Her husband, Tom, was Pete's corrections counselor. When Pete told Sandy he wasn't planning to be around for another Christmas, they tried to talk him out of suicide.
And I said, what's your main goal? Your main goal is to get out of here. And I said, you do that. I said, your family's going to always be remembered as the people whose husband, whose father, who did this. And I said, you can't do that to your family, meaning you can't harm yourself.
Tom, did he talk to you about losing hope as well?
Basically, I just listened to him. I let him talk. And then I just reassured him. I said, you know, you don't want to do what you think you're going to do because you need to fight and keep fighting because eventually you're going to get out.
You really believed that?
Yeah.
Their timing couldn't have been better because in the fall of 2018, a family friend called Dee with major news. There was a new prosecutor in town, and he was starting a unit devoted to wrongful conviction claims. Dee thought this could be Pete's chance.
And then I told him, this is what you have to do. You have to write a letter to the DA's office.
When Sandy heard that, she was all over him.
And I walked into work the next morning, and my boss said, so what time are you going to leave work today to get to the law library so that you can start this process? And I said, oh, I don't know whether I got it in me. And she said, you better, or I'll figure out how to call your wife. And with all of us working on it, you'll have it in you. You'll get this done.
Pete sat down to write a letter. Maybe his case wasn't over just yet. Coming up, could there be a silver bullet for Pete's defense?
Right there.
Pristine condition. Been sitting in the stuffing of that pillow, buried half an inch deep for 12 years.
By 2019, 11 years after Pete Koons' arrest, change had come to law enforcement in Kansas City. The regime that prosecuted him was gone, and a new district attorney was in charge. It was Mark Dupree. He played no role in Pete's original prosecution.
And you were a defense attorney at the time when the case was originally tried, right?
Yes.
And had nothing to do with this trial, of
course. Nothing to do with this trial at all.
When he was elected as DA, Dupree believed his mission was not just to prosecute the guilty, but to investigate claims of innocence.
We had told the community that if you believe that there are wrongful convictions, if you believe that one of your loved ones did not get a fair trial, please reach out and to let us know.
And when you first started the Convictions Integrity Unit, I mean, how many letters did you get?
A plethora.
One of those letters stood out, the letter written by Pete Coons.
As the staff brought it to me, they said, this is one of the best written letters that we've received from an inmate. And in that letter, he started with, I have never killed anyone in my life. And then he began to lay out all of the inconsistencies with the case.
Dupree's investigators looked closely at the case and quickly came to the conclusion that there were serious reasons to doubt Pete's guilt. They showed up at the prison and told him in person.
What was that like?
Like the weight of the world just fell off. And I sat there and just cried like a baby.
Now, the DA's office would work in conjunction with the Midwest Innocence Project and Pete's own attorneys to reinvestigate the case.
And so I drove out the other side of the state to go see him.
It had been almost 10 years since Brandon Bell tried and failed to get Pete's conviction overturned. The case had always bothered him.
And how much did that stay with you?
Honestly, I thought about walking away from the practice of law because I didn't want to be part of a system that could produce that kind of result.
So he and his colleague, Lindsay Runnels, jumped at a second chance to help. They dove into the case files provided by the new DA, and after some digging, Bell found something.
So I bring up the pictures of the bedroom, and I'm sort of scouring them pixel by pixel.
He had always thought there was something terribly wrong with the state's theory, that Pete had beaten Carl with an object before grabbing Kathleen's gun. Now here in the crime scene photos, he found evidence suggesting that Carl's head injury was actually a graze wound from a bullet.
And I see this sort of shadow in the stuffing. I'm like, what is that? And I blow it up a little bit more. I'm like, is that an object in there?
Lodged in a pillow on Carl's bed was a fourth bullet. Investigators had missed it at the scene. They pulled the pillow out of the evidence room, and there it was.
Right there.
Right there. Pristine condition. Been sitting in the stuffing of that pillow, just half an inch, buried half an inch deep for 12 years.
To Bell, that meant that Kathleen's gun was the only weapon used in the crime. More evidence the state's theory was deeply flawed. But who fired that gun? Well, also sitting in the evidence room were swabs from Kathleen's hands that had never been tested. The new DA's office sent them off, and sure enough,
it came back that, yeah, they had gunshot residue on her hand.
Her left hand?
On her left hand. And that the gun itself had only her DNA on it. And so this information combined then painted a whole picture. And that whole picture was not what the jury was able to see.
There'd never been any physical evidence linking Pete to the crime scene, but the jurors had heard plenty of incriminating testimony. Pete's attorneys tracked down Robert Rupert, the jailhouse snitch who claimed Pete had told him all about committing the murders. He had a different version of events now.
It was not true.
And did he admit of that? He admit he made it up?
He admitted that he was compromised in his testimony and that Pete never said that he killed anyone.
Rupert said he'd made up the story, hoping to get time off his own sentence. Not only was the story a lie, but right there in Pete's case file were emails warning that Rupert was unreliable. It was becoming clear to the current DA that Pete had not been treated fairly by the original prosecutor.
The state at the time knew that this specific jailhouse informant was not trustworthy, that he was just chasing after any way to get out of jail, and in fact had been told by another county prosecutor's office, don't use him, don't trust him. None of that information was turned over to the defense.
How is that possible?
There are those who are in these prosecutor positions that their focus is not justice. Their focus is winning. And I'll tell you that there was a policy in the office at that time. You do not dismiss murder cases. You try them at all costs.
There was also an email in the file that appeared to show the original DA, Ed Brancart, had pressured the jailhouse snitch into testifying.
Mr. Brancart tells his attorney, I'm going to have Rupert, your client, brought up here. Tell him this. Once he's here, he either has to answer his questions or he goes to jail.
So he's going to get more time was the threat.
Right.
All these discoveries were welcome news to Pete. His wife had another take.
Pete was like, they got new stuff, and it's all good stuff. And I'm like, if there's so much stuff, why couldn't we do this 13 years ago?
But remember, some of the strongest evidence against Pete was his conflict with the victim, a plausible motive. And of course, that phone call. But as Pete's attorneys dug through the old case files, all of that was about to turn on its head. What other motives were lurking there? Coming up, back to the theory of murder-suicide, but with a confounding question about Kathleen.
Why would she kill Carl, and then why would she kill herself?
This is a woman that was just drowning.
Investigators from inside the DA's office were now working with Pete Koons' attorneys to try to prove his innocence.
I was really good about being able to be hopeful, but not pinning all of my heart into it working. I tried really hard not to get my hopes up, because the harder you get your hopes up, the harder they fall.
There had been two trials, two guilty verdicts, and the medical examiner's conclusion that the crime was a double homicide. But as the new investigation dismantled the evidence bit by bit, it was looking more like a murder-suicide committed by Kathleen.
The only thing that doesn't make sense yet is motive.
Right.
Why would she kill Carl, and then why would she kill herself?
This is a woman that was just drowning. She was overwhelmed financially.
A little digging in the file revealed Kathleen was under tremendous financial stress. She was underwater with loan payments that far surpassed her monthly income. The prosecutor's team focused in on documents that showed she'd compensated by draining Pete's father's bank account.
How many thousands of dollars?
We knew that she had taken over $30,000 out of Pete's father's savings account.
The case against Pete had hinged on stories about his anger toward Kathleen, his desperation. But maybe Kathleen was the desperate one. Turns out she didn't just face losing her legal battle over the insurance money. She was possibly on the verge of facing criminal charges for embezzling from Pete's father.
At one point, the office was considering filing charges, and her attorney wrote a letter saying, if you're going to file, let us know. This was within months of her dying.
So she was expecting she might get charged.
There was no doubt. There was no doubt.
So the police had a file on her.
Police had a file on her. The very same prosecutor had a file on her. And so he knew what was going on, which all goes to really painting the entire picture of what was happening.
And the entire picture included this. Allegations she had also been stealing from the bank where she worked. Pete's attorneys went to talk with Kathleen's former coworker, Sandy. She told them how her boss discovered the bank books were off shortly before Kathleen died.
So he asked her to get it balanced if she couldn't to come to me.
And how much was it off by the account?
I believe around 11 or 12,000.
Sandy had never doubted that Kathleen had been murdered by Pete Koons, but as she spoke with his attorneys, it dawned on her that maybe there was more to the story. It seemed clear that Kathleen had every reason to be desperate, angry, the opposite of what the jurors had been told.
And the prosecutor says something in closing argument that just struck me as incredibly dishonest. He tells the jury in the closing argument of the second trial, Kathleen had no reason to take her own life. He knew that wasn't true.
Pete's attorneys came to believe that with her world collapsing, Kathleen did something not just drastic, but diabolical. And if true, it would turn the entire case inside out. Kathleen was not the victim, they said, but the villain. She'd planned to kill her husband and herself and bring Pete down with her, framing an innocent man for murder.
To frame me, that's pure evil.
Pete's attorneys said she'd been spreading false rumors about Pete, that he did drugs and had vandalized the house his father left her. And that story about that confrontation in the convenience store, they said, was made up.
These are breadcrumbs to, if the police start asking around, did she have any enemies? Is there anyone who might want to harm her? That they would all lead back to Pete.
And to come up with this plot, horrible plot, to frame Pete, why would she do that?
Maybe we'll never know exactly why she would do that, but if there's life insurance policies, and there were, it enables those to be paid out to people who are important to her, I imagine. And then Pete is somebody who she has, you know, probably some real animosity toward, right? Mm-hmm. He's called her out, and he's made public what she has done to his father.
And that phone call saying Pete was in her house, the attorneys say it did happen. Showed up right on her mother's caller ID. A final, decisive act to frame Pete before turning the gun on herself.
It's that phone call that started these dominoes, and from that point on, just the taint from start to finish.
I can't fathom what an evil person does that over something as common as money.
It was a head-spinning tale. Was it all just too far-fetched to be true? A judge was about to hear the story. Would he believe it? Coming up.
This is our chance to put the state on trial. So in essence, we're the prosecutors.
The pressure's on.
I went into panic because this was it. There was no second chance.
And then the judge's ruling.
I was in shock for a long time. Tears.
In November 2020, more than 12 years after his arrest, Pete Coons walked back into a Kansas City courthouse. But this time, he wasn't the one on trial.
This is our chance to put the state on trial. So in essence, we're the prosecutors.
Pete's attorneys laid it all out, the physical evidence that contradicted the state's case, the jailhouse snitch who recanted, Kathleen's history of embezzlement, her likely efforts to frame Pete, and the exculpatory evidence the state withheld.
We were victims of an evil plot that goes far beyond just what Kathleen decided to do.
Pete's attorneys said Kathleen's plot to frame Pete was so diabolical, it even extended to the way she killed herself. They believe she shot herself in the back of the head to make it look like an execution, not a suicide. Medical examiner Eric Mitchell, who testified at both of Pete's trials, says it's not impossible.
You get injuries to the back of the head with suicides, especially if somebody's trying to stage something.
In fact, all the new evidence led Mitchell to tell the judge he'd gotten the case wrong. He says it's a mistake he deeply regrets.
Not every decision you make is going to be correct, and you do have to be able to survive the impact of incorrect decisions because they will have an inordinate impact on others. But it does make it easier when it happens.
Still, as the hearing drew to a close, Pete's family couldn't help but expect the worst.
I went into panic because this was it. There was not a second chance. It was it.
Then the judge started to speak.
He started the conversation by telling the courtroom how hard it is sometimes to be a judge, and this was one of those days.
In the gallery, Dee couldn't tell what was happening. Her son tried to reassure her.
He's like, it's all right, Mom. It's all right. It's all right. This is how it has to go.
As he went through the evidence, he talked about the misconduct on behalf of the state. And then he just says, not fair. And in this country, you know, the due process clause means something. And it was violated. And we are sorry. And you are free to go.
That moment that the judge said, you're free to go.
I sort of went into a daze. I was like, it's over.
It was over after almost 13 years. Pete's wife couldn't believe it.
Brandon Bell walked over to her and said, don't you want to go hug Pete?
That hug, what did that feel like?
Overwhelming. Overwhelming. And of course, I was crying.
Kathleen's daughter, Blair, was not in court that day. She chose not to attend the hearing.
The day it happened, my aunt ran in my room and was like, they just released Pete. And I was like, what?
Blair was shocked to learn how the theory of the crime had changed. Her mother had gone from victim to villain. When we spoke with her a few weeks later, it was still sinking in.
I'm confused. I don't know what to believe.
If your mother did kill Carl and then kill herself, how do you process that?
If that did happen, I feel so bad for his family.
For Pete's family? DA Mark Dupree believes the ruling is a victory, even though the case represents a massive failure for the office he now leads.
This was, in my opinion, something that a first-year assistant district attorney learns never to do, and that is never withhold evidence, period.
That original prosecutor, Ed Brankhart, now works for the Kansas Attorney General's office. Brankhart didn't respond to our requests for comment.
What should be the repercussions for something like this?
We have a commission that reviews ethical complaints, and ultimately the Supreme Court of the state of Kansas makes a determination on whether or not an attorney should keep their license.
On November 5th, Pete Koons walked out of prison. His family was waiting for him.
All right, buddy.
Oh, it was like I was in a dream. Because it was like, you know, this is the day that we've all been hoping for, praying for so many years.
I can't wait to get to be dead all the time.
I was in shock for a long time. Tears.
When we met the Koons family in December 2020, they were just starting to make new memories together.
It is very much like picking the pieces back up and trying to put them back together. Dad and I had a pretty good relationship before everything, and that didn't really change when he came home.
Do you have a favorite moment just in these last few weeks that you've had him back?
Honestly, walking around Walmart, he gets so excited about picking things up, you know, like, oh, I haven't seen these in 13 years, you know, this is new. It's really awesome seeing him, you know, so ecstatic about little things that all of us would take for granted.
That first time getting to see your dad again, and for him getting to know his granddaughter, what was that like for you?
I don't think that there is a word to describe it. Seeing my daughter, you know, say grandpa and being able to point that person out is overwhelming.
I mean, it's amazing. I always knew that he was going to make a great grandpa.
Being able to put my arms around Deidre, free outside with no fence around us, was magnificent. Being able to hug my children was incredible. But I can't describe to you what it's like to meet your grandkids.
Pete got to spend this past Christmas together with his family. He told us he was looking forward, not back.
Down the road, 5, 10, 20 years. I like to say it's nothing but a speed bump in the rearview mirror. And if you don't dwell on it, you win. And I just want to spend the rest of my life being happy with what I have, not sad about what I lost.
But it turns out that Pete didn't have much time left. In early February, he was hospitalized. Doctors discovered he was suffering from stage 4 lung cancer. And on February 21st, Pete Coons passed away. It was just 108 days since his release. 108 days cherished by those who loved him. As hard as his ordeal had been, Pete Coons remembered his father's faith in the justice system. Before Pete died, he told us he still believed in it too.
A lot of this comes right back to everything he told me. Freedom's not free. It's tough. And you always stand up for what you believe in. And I did.